So we're at an interesting time in the United States with Trump in power and a resurgent far right. And the situation in the States has arisen very quickly. It's really come to this in the last year and a half, kind of from 0 to 100. We're seeing the biggest rise in white nationalist activism since the last big bulb in the 1980s and 1990s. Trump energized organized racism with his campaign promises to build a wall on the Mexican border and to register Muslims. In return, white nationalists eagerly grabbed on the coattails of his campaign, of his electoral campaign, and he in turn acknowledged them publicly, for example, in one case, tweeting a picture of himself as Pepe, the alt-right icon. There are perhaps hundreds of thousands of white nationalists and sympathizers, but there's a much larger group of people running in the millions of what might be called right-wing populists who exist around them. These are conservatives who are not neoliberals or traditional business conservatives, but have a kind of faux radical anti-elitism. They usually use a narrative like the people are under attack from the elites above them and subversives or parasites from below. So you might find this in Islamophobic currents that say global liberal elites are allowing immigration and Muslims are coming in and attacking the people and trying to subvert the society. Trump, in my mind, is a racist demagogue who stumbled onto these politics without a real ideological commitment to them. If you listen to his speeches, he almost sounds like an improv artist. He's finding his way around the sentences and trying to grab onto something. And you can tell when he gives talks or there's ads that are very pitch perfect, usually it comes out later that somebody else wrote it, for example, his advisor, Stephen Bannon. Right now, inside of the administration, there's a debate. Some people think there's a fight between his advisor, Steve Bannon, who's a right-wing populist, and his son-in-law, Trump's son-in-law, Kushner, over who will have influence in the administration, Kushner being more of a traditional conservative and an advocate of intervention overseas. It's hard to tell how much support Trump actually has. Although he won the election fair and square by in the American system, we have the Electoral College, which is a winner-take-all system by state. Although he won by the rules, he lost by about 3 million votes. And in particular, he won because the voter turnout for the Democratic Party was lower than it usually was. So very, very fewer people voted for Hillary Clinton than voted for Obama, and that's what brought Trump into victories. But it's unclear whether he actually has a very small level of support. But he does have a fanatical fan club, and this is what I call the independent Trumpist movement. They're the ones who are having these marches you might have heard about in the United States where there's clashes with anti-fascists, and they pull together different sectors of the right. So during the campaign, there was a lot of discussion in left media about whether Trump was a fascist. There's a lot of different definitions of fascism. There's even a whole discussion, if you read the scholarly literature, about how you define fascism. It's the discussion is called the fascist minimum, what elements you have to be a fascist. And so because there's so many elements, you can turn any leader into a fascist if you want to. Probably every president that I've been alive under has been, you know, people have made claims they're a fascist and given reasons for it based on elements similar to fascist governments. I don't think that Trump is a fascist because, in my view, fascism is an actual political movement, same way that anarchism is a political movement or Marxism is a political movement. It has a series of activists and organizations and ideas. You can watch the movement ebb and flow. And Trump doesn't have a lot of major aspect that fascists do. He never developed a party apparatus to take control. It's just him. He doesn't even have the unified support of his party. Trump doesn't make pure racial appeals. He's not attacking modernity. You know, Hitler in the original Nazi party platform wanted to abolish department stores. Trump loves the way that capitalism is structured and functioning. If you read the US fascist press, they'll say that Trump is not a fascist. They say, we like him, he's got some good ideas, but he doesn't go far enough. And then last, at least in the States, there's a tendency to consider a whole bunch of different kinds of right-wing nationalists or nationalist authoritarians to be fascists, whereas fascism is really just sort of one kind of right-wing nationalist authoritarianism. And for example, some of his followers like to compare him to Pinochet, and I think that might be a more apt comparison. His politics are very similar to the right-wing populist parties that have taken hold in Western Europe in particular. They are nationalists with anti-immigrant and anti-free trade policy. The difference being that he, in America, there's a particular tendency to combine a sort of soft white nationalism with libertarian economics, where they don't want to have a social welfare state. They want to have a very minimal federal state, but with de facto racist politics, and he fits into this tradition very cleanly. A nonprofit in Chicago called the Center for New Community, who monitor anti-immigrant and nativist politics, did an analysis of his appointees, and they only found that two of them had ties to actual racist movements. Some of them were tied to anti-LGBTQ politics, like the Family Research Council. Most of the other appointees with right-wing right-wing populist politics were fell into one of two strains. It was either anti-immigrant politics or Islamophobic politics. And these include Jeff Sessions, who's now the Attorney General, Mike Pompeo, who's the CIA Director, Ben Carson, who's the Housing and Urban Development Secretary, and Ryan Zinka, who's the Interior Secretary. There are only two appointees who have actual ties to racist political movements. The first one is Steve Bannon. He's Trump's chief advisor and a former member of the National Security Council. He was also the head of Breitbart News, and at the time claimed that it was the platform for the alt-right. And so he's often called a white supremacist in the United States, but to me he seems more like a sympathizer as well as a collaborator with the white nationalist movement rather than a member himself. He calls himself an economic nationalist, and his beliefs are rooted in a form of radical right-wing Christianity, which is, I don't believe that he's a Catholic, but it's most similar that you see in these radical traditionalist Catholic views. He courts the support of people of color, and he said about Trump's campaign promises that, quote, if we deliver, we'll get 60% of the white vote and 40% of the black and Hispanic vote, and we'll govern for 50 years. So to me, that's not the worldview of a white nationalist. The second appointee that has ties to organized racist movements is Sebastian Gorka. He's Trump's chief counterterrorism advisor. He's an Islamophobe with ties to far-right groups in his native Hungary, and he was a supporter of a paramilitary group there that was later banned. So it's possible that the Trump administration is now shifting a little bit more towards the center, with Bannon being sidelined and the influence of Kushner taking more dominance. If this does happen, Trump's administration will look a little bit more like a traditional conservative regime, even if it's to the right of George Bush. He'll try to dismantle many federal government agencies, in particular those that deliver social welfare goods. He's going to try to dismantle a lot of environmental legislation and regulation, and he's going to halt civil rights protections for historically oppressed groups, in particular LGBTQ people. So also some of the background in America is that hate crimes are up for different groups across the board, as far as we can tell. In November of last year, the FBI said that anti-Muslim assaults were the highest since September 11th. Between January and April of this year, there were 28 incidents at mosques, including 4 arsons, and I think just yesterday in Brooklyn, another mosque was burned. In February, an Indian man was shot to death in a Kansas bar. His murderer shouted, "Go back to your country." In March, a Sikh Indian was shot in his driveway in suburban Seattle, and the shooter yelled a similar statement. Looks like there's been a spike in anti-Semitic crimes. And in 2016 was a record high in violence against transgender people, with 26 transgender folks being murdered. So I'm going to give you, that's the background, I'm going to give you a bit of the details and nuts and bolts of what the white nationalist movement looks like in the United States today. One of the big things that's going on with it, one of the big changes is that it's reorienting now to being in alliance with the federal government. It had, during the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, it was the federal government that stopped segregation in the southern states. The cry for states' rights was the support of the Jim Crow segregation laws. And so it was the federal government that dismantled them, and the federal government that a lot of the civil rights, the Civil Rights Acts and protections were embodied in the federal government. And the white supremacist movement, which beforehand had been in favor of the federal government, then turned against it. In fact, by the 1980s, moving into a revolutionary position and attempting to overthrow the U.S. government. The most well-known group from this is called the Order, which was an underground group that did some assassinations and bombings. But with Trump, we're now seeing the white supremacist movement reorient in favor of the government. Obviously, they want to see Trump succeed. As long as Trump is fording these anti-immigrant and Islamophobic goals, they're in support of it. They've also come back in support of the police because of the Black Lives Matter movement, which they oppose. Many white supremacists support the Blue Lives Matter movement. And they're working directly with the police in the in the street demonstrations. They're, you know, unlike in the 80s and 90s, Nazi skinheads weren't necessarily, and the police weren't necessarily the best of buds. And they there was sometimes a three-way fight between the cops, anti-fascists, and Nazi skins. This isn't the case now. Many of the street white supremacist demonstrations are acting directly in concert with the police. They're happy to appear in public. They're happy to use the police to arrest their opponents. So I'll go through some of the groups that exist in the United States. We still have the Ku Klux Klan. People often think this is a national organization, although this hasn't been the case since the 40s. Nowadays, anybody, if you want to start a Klan group, you just declare yourself a Klan leader, order some robes off of eBay, get your friends together, and burn a cross on somebody's yard if you want. There's about 130 groups today. This is a leveling off. Last year, there were about 200 groups, but the year before, there were only 70, so it spiked dramatically and now is leveling off, but there's still quite a number of groups. In America, we have a racist version of Christianity called Christian identity. It's racist and anti-Semitic. If you've ever heard the term mud people, it derives from Christian identity beliefs. There are, depending on whose count you take, between 20 and 100 groups. This was a very influential part on the older racist movement between the 70s and 90s. It's not so active now, but I think it remains as a reserve potential for the white nationalists. We have a lot of racist prison gangs. There was a revival of them a few years ago. The big change is now they're functioning both inside and outside of the prison system. They're often heavily armed, and the best part of it, perhaps, is simply that they're not so political. The Aryan Brotherhood is the biggest of these groups, although there's several of them. Like in many Western European countries, we have neo-Nazi parties. The biggest one is called, in the U.S., is the National Socialist Movement, or NSM. They have several hundred members. There's another group that's very active on Twitter called the American Nazi Party as well. Still have Nazi skinheads. Don't seem to ever go away. Been around in the U.S. They came to the United States around 87, 88. For a minute, all the national groups had collapsed except the Hammerskins, but they seemed to have bounced back. Now we have, in addition to the Hammerskins, Vinlanders. There's a bunch of new blood and honor groups. There's been a revival of the American Front, which was the first national Nazi skinhead group in the United States. And there's local and state groups like the Golden State Skinheads in California and Keystone State Skinheads in Pennsylvania. The Neo-Confederates are having a growth spurt. These are activists that look towards the Confederacy, during the American Civil War, when the southern states wanted to break off and have a slave-owning republic. They want to you know, bring this back and have the southern states secede. They're having a growth spurt as well, and the biggest group in these is called the League of the South. Also, in the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a growth, or at least a very visible presence in the states of what I call unorthodox fascists. These are groups that don't look or sound like, you know, typical open white supremacist, open anti-Semitic groups. There's something more subtle or more unusual about their politics. Many of them are third positionists. This is a kind of fascism that is against capitalism and for racial separatism. This can create some very odd alliances, or potential alliances or reorientation of these groups. They may, for example, a third positionist fascist group may, for example, emphasize reaching out to people of color who are also racial separatists, or may attempt to create alliances with left-wing groups against, for example, issues of globalization or some other financial issues. There's been a rise of esoteric Hitlerists who worship Hitler as a kind of god. And there are new Volkish forms of fascism which have their claws or are on the edges of radical ecological and the men's movement. The most well-known of these is a group in Virginia called the Wolves of Vinland. Similar to this is in New York City, we have a big Rock Against Communism scene, or RAC. I know that some of the same people are here in Quebec City who are tied to the New York scene. They are far-right skinheads with Islamophobic politics. They'll play all the old Nazi skinhead songs at their shows and sing Heil at them, but the catch is that it's a multiracial scene. In New York, there's actually two crews that comprise of this scene, 211 and B49, and the more Nazified one is B49, who are a Latino group. So there's some sort of very, very untraditional kind of far-right activity going on. So the last of the main groups that people I'm sure have heard of is called the alt-right. They have a more traditional white nationalist politics, but they've rebranded themselves so that they don't look like Nazi skinheads, Klan members, or old white men in suits. They have a real emphasis on misogyny, and many of the members have come out of the libertarian movement. They don't seem to have, none of the members, as far as I can tell, have really come directly out of the white supremacist movement. It's not like it's a rebranding attempt or something. They seem to mostly be coming out of other political movements into white nationalism. They partly were influenced by this unorthodox fascist milieu of the late '00s and early teens, because a lot of these groups were trying to create new cultural references and had a new look, and the alt-right is similar to it in that way. But they're much more explicit about their racism and anti-Semitism and misogyny, and it seems to be, there's no reason to be, whereas many of the groups before were rather cagey about what they were doing, and the alt-right seems to like, the mask is off and there's no reason to be subtle about these white supremacist politics. There's two main ways the alt-right functions. One of them is as an intellectual movement, and the other basically as trolls. For the intellectual part, the core ideas are basic white supremacist ideas, and it's strongly anti-Semitic, but on the surface at least, they incorporate a lot of European influences from the more intellectual movement there. Ideas like coming from the French New Right and the Identitarians. So for example, alt-right leader Richard Spencer says that he's an ethno-pluralist, and that what he advocates is, quote, peaceful ethnic cleansing. The alt-right is very successful in using social media like Twitter. They love memes and podcasts. They use podcasts to develop a lot of their ideas and for internal communication. They're really into trolling. Part of this comes out of the emphasis from the Manosphere and the Gamergate scandal. And they're very good at inventing clever terms like cuckservative, which worked its way into the conservative mainstream. And the use of the echo symbol, which are putting three parentheses around the name of someone who is Jewish or who they assume is Jewish. This is, to them, part of their strategy to, quote, name the Jew, and some attempt to show the supposed Jewish control of our society. They exist mostly online, but now they hold, they have these secret talks, invite-only talks in different cities like New York and Atlanta called forums. And they are trying to establish groups on the ground now. The movement varies from outright neo-Nazis to regular Trumpists. So kind of from the most Nazi to the least Nazi factions. The outright neo-Nazi, not the largest or most prominent outright neo-Nazi in the alt-right is Andrew Anglin. His website is the Daily Stormer. It's now the biggest Nazi website in the United States. It's eclipsed Stormfront, which was the biggest one for many years. The Southern Poverty Law Center says that Anglin has now established 30 groups on the ground. They're called book clubs, I believe. Richard Spencer is probably the most well-known alt-right figure. He runs a think tank called the National Policy Institute. They do a conference in Washington, D.C. every couple years. And he's established with some other figures a new website called altright.com. The one of the groups that's something of a predecessor, but is part of the alt-right, predecessor to it, but is part of the alt-right is the American Freedom Party. This is the biggest white nationalist electoral vehicle. They were some of the more prominent people involved in this are Kevin MacDonald, who is an anti-Semitic evolutionary psychologist, professor of evolutionary psychology, and Tomislav Sunic, who's a Serbian new rightist. There are some alt-right groups are focusing on recruiting at universities, and there's two groups, Identity Europa and American Vanguard, who this is the focus of their work. In the past, the white supremacist movement wasn't very intellectual, but now there's a bunch of different journals and book presses. These include American Renaissance, Occidental Quarterly, the website Countercurrents, although there's also a left-wing website under the same name, and book presses like Arctos. Some of the American and Swedish alt-right members have moved to Budapest, Hungary, and are now establishing an international hub there. Another important group that's also something of a predecessor and is half in, half out of the alt-right is called the Traditionalist Worker Party. They're led by a fellow named Matthew Heimbeck. He's 26 years old, looks like an average middle class, millennial guy, so that gives him a very different presentation than other Klan or Nazi groups, but they have the usual racist and anti-Semitic politics. They're, however, also have a veneer of third positionism, and they're pro-North Korea and pro-Alexander Dugin. They work in a group called the Nationalist Alliance, which is an umbrella group of a dozen or more. The numbers always shift. Smaller groups, and the biggest of which, or the most important of which, is the NSM, the Neo-Nazi Party. So the Traditionalist Worker Party and the NSM are doing a two-day event in eastern Kentucky, I think at the end of the week, on April 28th and April 29th. They're targeting this area in Kentucky. Is almost entirely white, and 80% of it voted for Trump, and is economically depressed. And so they're targeting these areas on the basis of, if they think, well, if you like Trump, then you'll love, like, outright white nationalism. Last, there's a bunch of people that I usually refer to as the alt-light. A lot of campus Republicans fit into this group. They're into the style and form of the alt-right, the trolling and the deeply misogynistic approach, the anti-left-wing politics, but they're not explicitly white supremacist, and they usually differ over the anti-Semitism. Mike Cernovich might be an example of the representative of this group. And then, as I said before, surrounding the smaller group of open white nationalists is a much larger pool of different movements that might be called right-wing populists. They include Islamophobes. There's been about a 200% increase in Islamophobic groups in the United States, according to the SPLC. I know there's a lot of Soldiers of Odin activity here. We do have that group in the States, but there isn't so much street activity in the States. There have been some marches. There was armed, I don't know if Soldiers of Odin did this or not, but there was an armed marches outside of mosques in Arizona. The Soldiers of Odin in the States, at least, and maybe it's the same here, are important because they create, they're a point where all different kinds of right-wing groups can come together. You'll find Nazis in them as well as Patriot Movement members, and all different kinds of right-wingers can come participate in this group. So it's a nexus between things. There's a large conspiracy theory milieu. Alex Jones's InfoWars website, which used to be something of a treated as a joke, is now a major media organ. Trump appeared on InfoWars while he was running for president, and Alex Jones claims that after the victory, Trump called him to thank him for his support. Breitbart's a new media source in the last few years. It's become very popular as well. You know, it's to the right of Fox News, and I think before I would have been surprised that there could have been mainstream media to the right of Fox News, but clearly I'm wrong. And so their former head is now Trump's main advisor. We still have a large Christian right in the United States who are tied closely in with the anti-LGBTQ movement. They're expecting a lot of gains and inroads in the Trump administration. They have, in particular, decided that their line in the sand is going to be transgender rights, their opposition to transgender rights. The approval of same-sex marriage by the Supreme Court didn't set off the kind of response that maybe we would have expected. They kind of let that go, deciding instead that the focus would be to make sure that trans rights didn't succeed in the U.S. We also have a lot of economic nationalists, many of whom are paleoconservatives. This is a kind of social and economic conservatism. It's anti-free trade. They're a nationalist in their economic approach. They're very Eurocentric, but tend to stop just short of open white nationalism. Two important alt-right leaders came out of the paleoconservative movement. Both Richard Spencer and Matthew Heinbeck originally were paleocons. Of course, have anti-Semites. There's been anti-Semitism in Western countries for 1,000 years, and this isn't going away. There's a lot of conspiracy theory-driven libertarian economists. The best known of these are Ron Paul. You know, a lot of these things concentrate on conspiracy theories about the role of the Federal Reserve and other central banks. This can often lead quickly into anti-Semitic conspiracy theories about Rothschild's banks and other claims like that. In the United States, we have a large patriot movement. This is, they're best known for their policy of forming militias. They also form fake courts. Sometimes they'll create fake governmental structures that are shadow governments. The sovereign citizen movement comes out of this. In other countries, it's known as free man on the land. Many of these people claim that pretty much they're exempt from pretty much any kind of federal laws or regulations. So the Patriot Movement became very well known in the U.S. because of two armed conflicts, one in 2014 when a cattle rancher in Nevada, Cliven Bundy, the federal agents came in to seize some of his cattle because he refused to pay grazing fees for grazing on public lands. The other was, and he called in some of his militia friends, and they pointed, they came in armed and pointed guns at the federal agents and drove them off. There's a trial ongoing right now about that. Second incident happened last year in January when some of Cliven Bundy's sons traveled to Oregon and took over a wildlife refuge. They were actually, all of the leaders were acquitted at a jury trial. They were not sent to jail. So this gave the movement a big boost by able to pull these actions off and not be in prison for them. And then last, there's a big men's rights movement. I think it probably has already peaked. It doesn't seem as influential. It helped fuel the alt-right, but there's a lot of people in the manosphere still around. The most worrisome new development is what I call the independent Trumpist movement. These are the people holding the street demonstrations that you might have heard about in the last few months. It's a combination of Nazis, alt-right, patriot movement, and a regular Republican Trumpist who are all working together. And in the past, you wouldn't see these groups work together. It was usually enough to point out that somebody was had ties to white supremacists to break an alliance with Republicans, but that's no longer the case. It looks like these marches are organized outside of the Republican Party apparatus. They look like they're totally independent. And in them, it looks like the Nazis and other white supremacists are acting as the most militant members of the demonstration and fighting with anti-fascists and others. But the presence of regular Republicans allows them to pull large numbers to their side. So this is a worrisome new development. And then last, I've been asked to talk about the anti-fascist movement in the United States. There's been a self-conscious anti-fascist movement since the 1930s, which is when fascists, came to the United States. There were pro-Nazi groups like the Silver Shirts and the Bund, and anti-fascists fought with them. In the 1970s, this movement was largely Marxist-Leninist. In the 1980s, as the Nazi skinhead movement established itself, so did an opposition, and the movement, so the Antifa movement moved from being Marxist-Leninist to being mostly in the punk and skinhead scene and being mostly anarchist. In the late 80s, anti-racist action formed, which peaked in its member groups around 1996 with about 200 groups in the United States, in Canada, and I believe some in Latin America. In the late 80s, SHARP was formed, Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice, and in their early 90s, RASH, Red and Anarchist Skinheads. A lot of these groups by the, at least for ARA, with the anti-globalization movement, which in the US started in late 99, a lot of the ARA groups folded into this more militant wing of the movement, and the movement did not go away, but was pretty much on the low burner for a lot of the O's and teens. Every two or three years there would be a Nazi rally, but there would be a large counter demonstration and raucous counter demonstration organized that. But it wasn't like a very popular kind of activism. In 2013, the Anti-Racist Action Network folded and the Torch Network superseded it. To me, this signaled a real change. I don't think this was an important organizational move, but it sort of was an important symbolic changing of the guard. Around the same time in Britain, the Anti-Fascist Network was formed, and the earlier group there had been Anti-Fascist Action, so there clearly was like a change going on and who was involved in this kind of activism. In 2014, I think there were only about a dozen Antifa groups in the United States, but in 2015, this started to change. Three things happened during the summer of 2015. The website It's Going Down started publishing regularly, and this is now the main sort of organ for anti-fascists in the United States. The International Anti-Fascist Defense Fund was started by Antifa International. They collect funds both for anti-fascist prisoners as well as for medical bills, lost wages, and other financial needs that anti-fascists have. And third, the July 25th International Day of Solidarity with Anti-Fascist Prisoners started. This is a day for people to do any kind of activism in support of anti-fascist prisoners around the world. So these all appeared around the same time. In November of 2015, there was going to be a Hammerskin March in Seattle, Washington. And although it never materialized, there was a counter demonstration that hundreds of people attended. So it was the first really large, I think, anti-fascist demonstration in a while. In February of 2016, there was a clash in Anaheim, California. If you saw the picture for the Facebook event for this, it's a picture of that from Anaheim. A Klan group was having an event, and some, I believe, sort of loosely organized anti-fascists called a counter demo, but when they showed up, there weren't any police there. And normally, when there's going to be a demo, a fascist demo, and a counter demo, the police in the states flood it and make sure that the sides can't get at each other. And so the police just weren't there. And there was a number of anti-fascists were stabbed, and I believe at the end of all of this, only the anti-fascists have been charged with criminal acts in this, and none of the Klan members have been. So this signaled a difference in how the police were going to handle these confrontations. In June of 2016, there was a racist demonstration in Sacramento, California. It was officially under the banner of Matthew Heimbeck's Traditionalist Worker Party, but we believe that the people who were actually there were members of the Golden State Skinheads, a Nazi skinhead group. About 400 anti-fascists invaded the courthouse and dispersed the demonstration rather quickly, but a number of people were stabbed again, and a loaded gun was found dropped, assumably by the Nazis. I think right now, similar that this is probably the high point of the white nationalist movement since the 80s and 90s, it's the same with anti-fascists. A lot of people have floated to the anti-fascist movement. People seem to be using less the sort of, for organizing less the kind of crew model that was based on a discrete number of people and embedded in a subcultural scene, and are using organized techniques that are more, sort of these more militant, decentralized social movement style techniques. Groups today in the United States are mostly anarchists. There's been a generational shift. I don't think a lot of people who are involved in the anti-fascist movement today are the same in the 90s. And the older movement, a lot of people are very young. We're 15 to 25 years old, and I think people are a little bit older now. Before the inauguration, there had been a shift away from direct confrontation by anti-fascists. Some of it was dealing with all this crypto-fascist and orthodox fascist stuff and attempts to unveil cross-recruiting and do educational programs. But since the inauguration in January of this year, there's been a dramatic shift back towards confrontation. This is because of two reasons. One, there was a large black bloc that was billed as anti-fascist at the inauguration. And about 200 people were arrested. The police ended up kettling a black bloc and arresting 200 people. And then the other was the video of Richard Spencer being punched, which became this sort of internet sensation. And so, for the first time, the black bloc has become synonymous with anti-fascism, which is strange. Anti-fascists had used black bloc techniques before, but not very often. And so maybe 5 years ago, black bloc would be synonymous with anarchism. So now it's with anti-fascism, and people have taken a very militant pose to attempt to disrupt, racist demonstrations, either directly by white supremacists or which they're involved in. People are still doing a lot of doxing, but it seems to be less effective. Trump seems to have normalized, at least in some quarters, being a white nationalist. Like, so some people are just like, yeah, I don't care, you can put my picture up, I have no shame in this. There's been a lot of the protest on university campuses, and that's because the alt-right is trying to recruit there and send waves of speakers there. There was a shooting in a Seattle campus in January, an alt-right person, this couple, shot an anti-fascist, was actually trying to de-escalate the situation. And then in February, there was a huge demonstration at the Berkeley campus, and they shut down a Milo Yiannopoulos talk. He was the Breitbart writer that had written a crucial article that mainstreamed the alt-right. This evolved into a bunch of clashes with the independent Trumpists. There was a national demonstration on March 4th called the March for Trump, and this was the same day that there were Islamophobic demonstrations here in Canada. At Huntington Beach in March 17, there was a demonstration in which a small number of anti-fascists confronted a much larger group of Trumpists and were defeated by them while the police stood by. And then more recently, in April 15, there was a third far-right rally in Berkeley, and this combined a lot of alt-right members, Nazis, and Patriot Movement leaders. Along with Republicans. I think about 500 people came on both sides. The police did not intervene very much, and it was either a tie or a victory for them, depending on who you ask. The people on the right are claiming it as a victory for them. So there's been a lot of police repression. There were 200 arrests in D.C., and they kettled people and arrested them, which is not uncommon in a demonstration, but they charged everybody initially with 10-year sentences. And that's a very unusual thing, to charge so many people with such a high sentence. Although it seems likely they're going to, and I think they're starting to do it, get plea bargains for lower-level people and just shuffle this up until only a few people have these real charges. But it was really astounding to watch. The fact that they charged everybody with that high of a crime signaled that the state is going to use a very heavy hand to suppress demonstrations. And then more recently, for this clash in Sacramento last year, the California law enforcement has recommended that charges be pursued against 100 people. They issued a 2,000-page report. And these charges haven't happened yet. I think they're going to a grand jury, but they recommended that it would. So things have evolved very quickly in the last 4 months. You seem to be at, I think, a turning point and a reflective point about how people are organizing and counter-organizing, but things are still in flux, and it's unclear what the future is going to be.